Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello and welcome to Conversations with the Boyce of Reason. I'm your host, Benjamin Boyce, and today's guest is Nina Power, who is a professor of philosophy in the United Kingdom. She's of Irish descent, just in case that matters to you. She wrote a book in 2009, it came out, and it was called The One-Dimensional Woman. Covered women's issues. This year, in August, to be more precise, she is releasing a book titled What Men Want. So she's been investigating gender issues from a philosophical standpoint. And in this particular conversation, that's what we talk about. We talk about identity and gender and men and women, how they don't get along, how they do get along, and basic philosophical principles. Really like her energy. I love her mind and how she thinks. And I think that we synced up rather well in this combobulation of interview topics. So without further ado, here is Nina Power. You know what? I got an OED yesterday. It came in the mail, like the compact version of the Oxford English Dictionary, which completely distracted me from totally digging into all your work, because the English language is kind of like a fetish of mine for some reason. But so today I was catching up on articles about you and interviews about you. And somebody in The Guardian said that you were into critical theory. And I've been doing kind of a series on critical theory. And I was wondering if you wanted to talk about your stance on that, because I've interviewed a lot of people who are against it, and I've seen certain manifestations of it that I find troublesome. So, but I think you find it useful.
Yeah, I suppose you have to be very clear what we mean by critical theory. I mean, I would first and foremost define myself as a philosopher. That doesn't sound too pretentious. I mean, certainly that's my training. Yeah. And that's what I teach. So, I mean, critical theory, insofar as it kind of exists, often just refers to a certain kind of take up of particular philosophical ideas, you know, for, let's say, contemporary relevance or something like this. I mean, there are obviously critical theory traditions, if you think about the Frankfurt School and, you know, that come out of Marxism and so on. And you know, critical legal theory or critical race theory. I mean, I don't know, because I think some of these things have maybe shifted meaning in the past little while. Like, I think maybe they did refer to actually a whole series of questions in a body of text, but not a dogmatic ideology. You know, I mean, yeah. The clue is in the word. I mean, critical would be to in a sense be critical of everything around you, including the theory itself or any one particular theory. So
yeah,
I mean, a lot of critical theory was attacking ideology and was attacking dogma.
Yeah. What's your basic, where did you start, like, philosophically? Like, what are, like, your roots and kind of where are you now in the work that you do or your thought?
Yeah, so I suppose, I mean, I went to Warwick and I did undergraduate philosophy there. And Warwick had quite a reputation in the 90s, being at the forefront of particular kind of ideas around cyber utopianism, and it had this event called Virtual Futures, and Nick Land taught there, although I was never taught by him. And so there was a kind of attempt to fuse, let's say, theory with what was happening, developments in technology, I suppose, and particular images of the future. But in a way, I was always quite resistant to some of that. Everyone kept saying that they were an anti-humanist, for example. Like, everyone had to say they were an anti-humanist at the end of the 90s.
Anti-humanist?
Yeah. Huh. So there are lots of different ways of being an anti-humanist, right? Lots of different motives. And I would always be asking, what's wrong with being a humanist?
You know? What was wrong with being a humanist?
Well, exactly. So I eventually wrote my PhD on this idea of of humanism and anti-humanism. And yeah, it just turns out that people often don't really know what they mean when they say anti-humanism or humanism for that matter.
Or humanism. Do you have an operative definition of humanism? Because that's one term that's always shifting for me. So I never.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in a kind of enlightenmental way, we would say it's the kind of belief or commitment in human reason as the basis for organizing things in a way that is conducive, hopefully, to human happiness. But I mean, humanism has its very unpleasant sides too, as do pretty much every political ideology.
Yeah, such as, I guess, what, like?
Well, a lot of the early humanists were also kind of committed to the idea of eugenics in particular ways.
Yes.
You know, and yeah, this idea of like improving the species, you know, various ideas of kind of social Darwinism and so on. So I think, you know, whenever you're looking at the history of these terms, you know, sometimes they have useful elements, but yeah, we shouldn't be kind of complacent about any one dogmatic ideology, you know, whichever one is trying to assert itself at any particular moment. And I think the moment people start saying, no, we can't talk about this, or there's no debate, or there's nothing to discuss, then, you know, this is a problem.
Yeah. It's exhausting to always be questioning all the time, but whenever you're told not to question anything, that's when you should totally go full question.
Yeah, I think for some people it's almost impossible not to. You know, if somebody says don't do something or don't think about this or whatever, it's you feel like you must. And philosophers are historically incredibly annoying people, right? I mean, states put them to death because they're so irritating. Because they always ask these like really annoying questions, like why are we doing this, or what is this system for, or why do you think this word means this thing? You know. So they're always leading young people astray and, you know, causing havoc. So.
And in your popular work, you've been attracted to, or you've gone into discussions around gender. You did a book called The One Dimensional Woman, and now you're doing a book on what men want.
Yes.
In what way is, what are some of the tools that you're using in philosophy to engage in gender and sex?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite a kind of complicated question in a way. I think partly just simply questioning assertions. So one of the major assertions today, I suppose, is that the binary is a problem. Like binaries are bad, you know, like to say that there are men and there are women is, you know, often attacked. Or to say that there are definitions of these words that work in particular ways and they have a particular use and they have a historical and social meaning. You know, even to say that sometimes is kind of quite controversial. And I think a lot of women in particular have obviously been attacked very badly for, you know, trying to preserve language around womanhood and, you know, at a legal level or a social level or a political level. And so I suppose in a sort of philosophical way, it's kind of to ask questions about, this increasingly dominant narrative. So one of the major dominant narratives that seems to have emerged in the last 5-10 years is this idea that men are bad, simply, you know, that men are somehow irreparably awful and toxic, and, you know, that masculinity is, that there's no good idea of masculinity. And I suppose just on some kind of visceral personal level, I just found this to be untrue. You know, it's like most of my encounters with men and the men that I love and care about and who are my friends, it doesn't fit. Like, it's just not an accurate description of my empirical experience of the world, right? Mm-hmm. It's not to say that some men don't do bad things, right? You know, men are responsible for most intrapersonal violence, usually against
most
each
bad
other.
Things are caused by men, but most men don't do cause bad.
Yeah, exactly. And most male violence is directed at other men or against themselves. And in terms of male suicide, which is obviously quite high and in most Western countries. And so I suppose it was, I mean, philosophers also always go back to basics all the time. They always want to reassert the fundamental questions, you know. So are there no things? Is there one thing? Are there two things? Are there many things? you know, and often it's a battle over numbers in a way, or how we divide things, you know. So I mean, to sort of start with the assertion, like, that there are two sexes, and, you know, there are men and there are women, and we all have to live together, and all of us are alive, if we are alive, if we're still alive, and we have a kind of sort of unavoidable social life together. You know, you can try and be a separatist, and I talk about separatism in the book, you know, whether we're talking about kind of lesbian separatism in the 70s or men going their own way, you know, these kind of separatist movements. It's quite interesting to compare them, the similarities and differences. But actually, most of the time, we live in a mixed world, you know, at work or at school or in just outside, you know, whether we choose to spend time with members of our own sex or the other sex, you know, nevertheless, there's a kind of reality to other people. And, you know, there's bound to be kind of disagreements and so on. And we all have to kind of struggle to get on and live together. And I suppose, you know, I'd seen a lot of men be very unduly punished, I think, for minor transgressions. And I think I was thinking about reconciliation, really. It was like, how do we get beyond, like, resentments, some of which might be well placed. But I think there's a kind of media campaign. Like, it's very easy to kind of encourage resentment. Like, if you say this group of people are responsible for all of your problems. Right. So you say to women, men are to blame for all of your problems. Or you say to men, women are responsible. You know, you've had one bad experience with one woman, therefore all women are bad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, resentment is a very, very powerful force. Right. You don't need to read Nietzsche to understand how powerful it is. Right. And lots of people make a lot of money and you know, gain. I don't know. You can manipulate people by encouraging resentment quite easily. And I suppose it was thinking about, like, what happens after Me Too and what happens after, you know, this historical reckoning, and, you know, how can men and women then get back to having a laugh?
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
Or being friends, or just, you know, they don't have to be friends, but, you know, just like encountering each other in the world and not being afraid of each other, actually, I suppose. Yeah.
I critique a lot of the implementations of what certain people call queer theory, which is, I guess it's proposing a solution of infinite genders or no gender or violating the binary and, you know, allowing people to identify into all these categories that, you know, you ask, well, what is it made out of? And it's very self-referential. Even some of the categories are, I don't have a category. Which is like, okay, what are we really talking about anymore? And, you know, I keep on proposing, like, if you guys want to make this system work, I want to see the epic. I want to see the Odyssey. I want to see the, you know, the Vanity Fair. I want to see society implemented and a good story happen in this, because narrative makes things make sense for me. So I just wonder if you've done any thought experiments in that way, and if what you're proposing now is kind of a thought experiment in a certain respect of reconciliation between these two sexes. And are you drawing upon cultures past? Are you looking towards a better cultural future?
Yeah, I think both to some extent. I mean, you know, like, the word for man, via, is also the root word for virtue. And we live in a kind of post-virtue culture in many ways, right? The very idea of virtues is kind of anathema, right, to the modern mind. You know, like, we obviously generally largely live in a secular, post-religious, you know, free-for-all of, I don't know, of beliefs or no beliefs. And this still doesn't give us any guidance as to how we are supposed to behave or how we're supposed to treat each other. And, you know, so obviously this goes wrong quite often. You know, people often make mistakes. And I think a lot of things that are put down to malice are often just errors, you know, in terms of people upsetting each other and, you know. But I think on the, I mean, one of the major shifts has happened on the question of gender, right? So John Money comes up with this concept of gender, right? He's trying to detach sex and gender, and he tries this experiment himself, very disastrous, on these two boys, the Reimer twins, and mm-hmm. you know, one of them loses his genitals in an accident, and John Money thinks, well, okay, we can bring this boy up as a girl, and you know, because gender is socialization, right? That yes. gender is separable from yeah. sex.
It's not emergent at all. It's all cultural. Yeah. Blank slate, kind of.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. And then, you know, some of the second wave feminists think this idea of gender is very useful, right? Because it says, right, women don't have a natural, you know, that women have been told that they have to be a certain way on the basis of their biology, mm-hmm. right? But actually...
Made, not born, yeah.
Yeah. And that, you know, and this imposition is called gender, right? And it's kind of imposed upon sex. So gender becomes like the negative expectation of how you're supposed to behave. Mm-hmm. And so for a lot of the second wave, it's about expanding or even abolishing gender, right? Getting rid of gender, because gender is a social imposition, and it's mm-hmm. and it inhibits both boys and girls and men and women from doing and being who they want to be, who they want to love and what they want to wear and what interests they have and so on, right? So, but it's a kind of double-edged sword that they do this, right? Because then gender becomes so detached from sex in a certain way, you know, and that gender starts to take on this other meaning, which is just something like a feeling, you know, it's an inner feeling. I feel like this. But gender then becomes what we used to call personality or character, you know. So the question might maybe is like, what has happened to personality or character, you know? Hmm. Like, why are people... not I don't know, in a way content yeah. to be a kind of constant process of ambiguity and becoming, and you know, that yeah. this kind of lockdown on identity and so on is yeah. a kind of symptom of insecurity, you know, because it's like saying I am this, you know, but no one is ever this, right? Yeah. People are always just in the process.
And then they create a this that can be any of those, you know, like fluid or queer or whatever, mm. like, because like they even, there's like a subconscious understanding that what they're doing is trying to escape category while clinging to category at the same time.
Yeah. And like to kind of, you know, blow up the categories. I understand that kind of motive, right? It's like everybody should be free to express themselves however they want. Right. There is no kind of issue with that. And I think that's what we were moving towards. And you could say that the second wave was genuinely progressive in this regard, right? It was trying to, you know, get rid of those sort of gendered expectations for both boys and girls and men and women. Hmm. And, you know, permitting a kind of greater bandwidth of like expression. And somehow that kind of got changed. And I don't know, like so completely detached from reality in a certain way that, I don't know how to put it. It's like, it's no longer about who you are as a person, as a character, yeah. all of the mistakes you've made, all of the things you think, you know, but something else, something much more rigid. Yeah. So there's a kind of paradox, I suppose, in this idea that that fluidity becomes rigid. And I mean, something like non-binary, I mean, of course, is the most binary, because if you say you're non-binary, it depends on everyone else being boring and binary yeah. for you to define yourself against them. Say like, oh, I'm much more interesting. I'm a curious combination of masculine and feminine. Or yeah. no, and it's like, well, everybody is a curious combination of masculine and feminine, you know?
Yes.
It's like everybody's yeah. non-binary, right? It's like, yeah. there's not even the most extreme stereotypical cases in that culture are still going to not be like, a, you know, apex woman and apex man, right? Everybody yeah. has a whole series of interests and
yeah.
mannerisms and expressions and whatever. So yeah. I don't know. I think there's been this colossal confusion about, character or personality and identity, you know, which happens to be very, very amenable to a particular kind of capitalist, consumerist online culture.
Okay. Capitalist, consumers. Okay. I want to propose something, because we're doing a lot of shotgun, which I love. So like there's all these concepts floating around in this cool soup. But it seems like earlier in that we were talking about how virtue Like, we lost virtue. And I think, I propose that we lost virtue because we wanted to be free from religion. We wanted to be free from a hierarchical structure. But that came with virtue. So we didn't know where to put virtue. And we also wanted to be free to be from norms. Like, we want to have this ability to be beyond norms or interact with a norm whenever we feel it's suitable. But the problem with human beings is that the way that our mind works with the future and with the past is that we come up with these heuristics and these expectations, which become normative. Like, we need norms in order to navigate the environment. And the breaking free from norms, the breaking free from religion, also kind of like the breaking free from virtue or expectation of behavior, the ability to judge behavior, we lost the network in which we found ourselves. We lost that which we were able to contextualize our individuality, our who, and the process of developing that who and relating that who to other whos. And without that structure, now it's just fragmented into a bunch of whats. I like where you put in that some sort of capitalist consumerist culture is now the guiding normative force in a way in how we market ourselves, actually, in that we market ourselves as this, as that. We have a profile and a bio with all these different signifiers that signify all these different interactions and stuff and distill it down into easily digestible bits so that people can recognize us as this, as that, as the other thing. So
balls
in your court.
Yeah, one of the things that I suppose comes to mind is this question of community. I mean, if you have smaller communities in which people know each other and you have networks and, you know, there is a kind of, if somebody starts sort of acting out or is obviously very unhappy or something like this, then it becomes a question for the whole community because it's also reflecting, you know, the community's values, as it were, right? Mm-hmm. So there, if you detach people as individuals, if you know, when you atomize people and they become completely unmoored from any sense of community, or they try to recreate community at a global level, let's say on internet platforms, you know, they're still a striving for some form of basic thing like recognition, for example, you know, acknowledgement of people's pain and suffering, and, you know, everybody suffers, you know, like, I think the problem is with this kind of hierarchy of suffering is the idea that some people's pain is more privileged than other people's, you know, or that some people, if they suffer, they don't really suffer, you know. And I think this is one of the problems, and I try to talk about this in the book, is like a zero-sum game. You know, if social life is conceived as a zero-sum game, then everybody is competing for small amounts of, like, attention or, you know, so these will become, like, partly strategies for gaining attention.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
If you assume that there's only a limited amount of it.
Okay. Is there?
No.
Is there not? No. There's infinite attention.
Yeah. I mean, attention is just whatever you choose to pay attention to, right?
So. Okay. But if you want it from other people, it is a resource.
Yeah, sure. And I think, but I mean, let's say marriage is a commitment, right? Marriage is still happening. It's relatively unpopular these days. You have apps, you can go and meet, you know, a million people and have sex with random strangers. And the worst thing you can do is fall in love with them, because that would be a terrible acknowledgement of your human failing, right? But let's say you commit yourself to somebody and you're married to them for like 25, 40 years. Like, let's say you take the till death do us part seriously. You know, in a way, the decision is also about attention, right? It's like, I'm going to give my attention to this person and they're going to give the attention to me. And in a way, that should be sufficient. You know, I mean, you could say, well, not everybody gets a partner, right?
Yeah.
And then,
you
know, you have the incel question and this kind of thing, right?
Which is
a complicated one to answer. And I think a lot of men and women are not necessarily well positioned to want or to accept the idea of, you know, of being with someone else for that sustained period of commitment. You know, we have a very fleeting culture, a very fickle culture. So I mean, it depends which thing you think comes first, I suppose. Like, the disintegration of community is also a disintegration of virtue. But yeah, I mean, even if you're thinking about something like patriarchy, you know, this demon word, but the patriarch in the Bible is also someone who cares for other people. It's like the man who takes responsibility And it seems to me that like no one really wants to take responsibility, that actually there's a kind of lack of patriarchs in a certain way. As in, you know, to have people who are saying, right, okay, let's look after each other, you know, stop doing this, this is going to cause you pain. And, you know, that kind of human knowledge is based on a lot of folk wisdom and tradition. And all of those things have kind of been eroded as well, or they're kind of neglected. So we've kind of, even though humanity has learned all of these lessons, basically, and they're pretty much always the same because human beings haven't changed that much. You know, modernity hasn't really made us, you know, stop feeling particular emotions that are described before modernity.
Well, it depends on how liberal your psychiatrist is with the pills, but yes.
Right, exactly.
The mechanisms are still in effect.
No, sure. And I mean, you know, I was thinking today, just walking about in the sun, and, you know, how the language to describe very particular forms of emotion, you know, when you think about Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, or the humours, or these theories, you know, these, or Hobbes, when he describes all of these different emotions, Spinoza as well, you know, we kind of lose a language, we lose the subtlety of language to describe very specific emotions if we just say, oh, I feel sad or I feel happy, right?
Yeah.
There's a million different ways of feeling sad and happy, for that matter.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and then to bluntly kind of treat these things, as it were, you know, with medication, of course, it's like, you know, we're dominated in the 90s. You know, I remember Prozac and SSRIs really hitting the scene, right?
Yeah.
It became a kind of acceptable thing.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem with the idea of responsibility, okay, so the patriarchs in the Bible were responsible folk, but there was this notion undergirding that responsibility was responsibility to what they owned. And it's easy. There's one reading of ownership and property that it's a one-way street, that there's the one who controls the other thing. Then there's this other understanding, which is subtle, which I think might be lost, of this two-way street of being owned by your property, being your reputation is in how well you manage that or how that actually functions. So there's this, and this is ancient. So, and it, maybe it's an accidental structure that doesn't need to exist anymore. But the man, at least in the Bible times, we're talking, well, I'm not promoting this. I'm just saying that in this structure, the man was the outward facing, decider or whatever. And then the female inside of that was contained by the man, but her domain was, you know, kind of guarded by the man, but inside of his territory was actually her territory in a way. And due to the ways that the stories were told, due to the ways that the stories are interpreted, we can see the female as the lesser of the subjugated rather than understanding them being mutually subjugated and mutually reliant on one another. And that mutuality has been kind of disrupted by this idea or this reading of property. Not to say that property hasn't had its faults, and not to say that men haven't like fucked up the responsibilities that they've inherited and they've been given. So what do you think?
Yeah, sure. I think it's further complicated. I mean, in a way you're talking about the relationship between like the oikos and the polis, right? And oikos is the home, right? It's also where we get the word economics from, right? So
yes,
in a way what we have is a kind of entire world made market, like the, you know, the world is economic.
The personal is political,
Right, but it's so in a way that there is no private sphere. And I mean, feminists make this point too for very different reasons, but it's, you know, the public and the private are no longer separate entities, right? So you don't have that separation of like the domestic or the oikos, the household, and the political, right? You know, which would have been where men came to to decide how to solve disagreements, let's say. So given, I mean, in a way, like there, I think there's no going back, right? Like the genie is out of the bottle, as it were. Like women are obviously equally capable of almost everything men are, right? They're, women are workers, they're moral agents, they're sexual beings, you know, that to pretend otherwise, you know, and I don't think the older systems are necessarily pretending that they weren't that. It was just a different arrangement, right? But that arrangement is no longer possible, you know, and I think, you know, for better or worse, you know, so... But, you know, what you have, though, I think, is a generalized infantilization of the culture at the same time, right? So you have basically everyone is supposed to assume responsibility for themselves, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you have a culture that kind of encourages people to sort of dissipate their energy and to, you know, I don't know, get addicted or get, you know, run around sort of not, you know, not committing necessarily to mm-hmm. anything. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and not just relationships, but to careers and to, you know, I guess monuments, like working on a monument for, you know, 3 or 4 generations, that's not part of anything.
Yeah. So this kind of, you know, idea that there's always something better, there's always something new, you know, it's kind of fetishization of novelty, I suppose, you know, mm-hmm. which is in itself mm-hmm. very addictive. Yeah, so I don't know. So there's a kind of generalized lack of responsibility. And I mean, the two-way street thing is also interesting. I mean, if you read like Baudrillard's book on seduction, you know, he's a very interesting book where he talks about that. He says women have never lacked power, right? So this idea that, you know, women need to take power from men's worlds, you know, and that they, what women, you know, this idea of like representation, let's say having 50-50 men and women in parliament, you know, this kind of quotarization.
Of
representation, you know, and Baudrillard says that, like, this is to misunderstand what power is, you know, this is to misunderstand the power that women have always had. And he argues that in a way their power is usually on the side of a secret, you know, that it's something that can't be represented or articulated in a particular way. But, you know, if you think about the kind of control, you know, politically or domestically that women exert, you know, over the family or over men, mm-hmm. it's very powerful, right? Historically,
yeah.
you know, why
yeah.
do men do things? Many, many things have been created in order to impress women, right?
Yeah. 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 No. Yeah. You can see that in, you know, the stereotypical male feminists, like, oh, is this what women want? Then I'll be that. And then use that kind of as a cover for a lot of misogyny because he thinks he's like the regulation on his misogyny, so-called, is taken off because now he's championing women. You know, there's always that the men are always, we're always, a large portion of us are always subject to the power that women have over us. And I think that there's a large portion of misogyny that is actually a way of disparaging just how powerful women are. I'm talking about like locker room jokes and kind of disparaging women in voice, because it's actually a response to something that's, you know, troubling for the men and the men trying to get, you know.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's, I talk about this in the book, and I think it's absolutely worth acknowledging this power, both for men and for women to do that, right? And in order to kind of, circumvent, preempt this resentment, right? Because in a way, resentment is the problem. And
could you define resentment in this? Where does resentment come from then?
Yeah,
what's
I don't know.
What's a good theory of that?
Well, I mean, it comes from a feeling of lack, I suppose, of thinking that you don't have something that you think you want, you could say.
Or something was taken from you.
Yeah, or that someone else has something that you want, right? So let's say you don't have a girlfriend and you think you want a girlfriend, you know, and either you can resent other men, you can aim to be better, you can aim to improve yourself, right? You can go to the gym, you can work out, you can, you know, or you can blame women, you know, like MGTOW go very far in this regard in some ways, you know, when they kind of basically saying we're not playing this game, like all women are gold diggers, all women are X, you know, like.
And the system itself is set up to empower them over us. And because I know a lot of MGTOW have become that way because of the way that the, family courts have treated them, robbing them of their children and a lot of their property for the sake of what the woman wanted.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so there is kind of real feelings of resentment there, right, for, you know, correctly or otherwise. And
so what would be the opposite of resentment? Like if resentment is a great motivator, what is like a kind of maybe equal and opposite, but maybe not as attractive in the short term, but perhaps much more powerful in the long term?
I don't know. I suppose a combination of something like acceptance, but also perhaps a sort of like finding delight in the cosmos, you know, the
idea
that, that in a sense, it's not anyone's responsibility other than yours for changing your attitude, right? Like, you know, and that you can find beauty everywhere. Like you don't have to possess to go back to the, you know, conversation about possession. you know, that beauty is kind of all around you, for example. But I think it is very hard to get to that point.
Well, especially if you get stuck in there, if you don't do some very early work in life, or whenever you're met with a situation in which you are immersed in envy and resentment. You know, there's a moment in most of our lives where we have to go through like deciding whether or not to give ourselves over to resentment, or like wrestling with that and then putting structures in place where you're kind of immune to it going forward. Cause you understand, like, if I go down that path, that's where I'm gonna be. And I don't want to be in that place because everything is defined in such a way that limits my possibility for one example of why not to go that route.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you can hang your resentment on lots of different things. You could hang it on the opposite sex, but you could also hang it on capitalism, or you can hang it on, you know, your boss or whatever. It's kind of... And I think maybe coming to maturity or becoming an adult, which is becoming increasingly difficult, is also precisely recognizing or realizing this, which is why I think figures like Jordan Peterson attract such, on the one hand, you know, very welcomed and very popular, but on the other, are very attacked in a way, because it's very basic what he's saying. It's like, you know, take responsibility for your own life, you know? And that's like not a message that a lot of people want to hear. You know, because they want a structural explanation for why they feel individually miserable.
And there's validity to a lot of structural critiques. There's a validity to a lot of intergroup resentment. In America, we have certain groups that have resentment towards our structure because of historical wrongs that are objectively true. But then you ask, well, if we're going to go forward, to what degree, how do we treat the past and how do we articulate the past? And then people who don't have that burden, we're going to have to help you. We're going to have to work together eventually. So to what degree are we going to have to pay through various means to overcome and to nullify that resentment or those grievances, let's say. And I don't think that resentment necessarily has the proper, it doesn't end up with good outcomes quite often, though it's understandable.
No, absolutely. And so I think, yeah, it's not to say that people, it's illegitimate to feel this way. And in a way, the book, I was trying to actually listen to the resentment, right, of like men's rights activists, for example, which are usually dismissed. It's like, well, is there any, you know, what's the reality behind this, you know? And I think this process of listening is important. You know, I think a lot of the time people don't think that they're being heard, you know, and they say, like, I feel this, I'm upset about this. You know, this terrible thing happened to my people or to people like me. And, you know, and I think the urge to destroy or to just, you know, to pretend that the past was a bad place and the present is a good place, for example, and that all we need to do is just destroy all vestiges of the past isn't going to work, because human beings are not dissimilar. You know, we're the same kind of being. You know, this idea that you can suddenly become like this moral paragon and everyone before you was like an idiot and immoral. I mean, just can't be true, you know?
Well, and, or the opposite, the case of deifying people in the past and saying that they're flawless and above and beyond, you know, the trappings of my lowly morality or my time's lowly reality. You know, I think every age has heroes and different responses to the conditions of that age. And then those, the sins of that age are indelibly stamped in the characters of, you know, the heroes of that age too. You know, there's always more than one dimension, two dimensions, and it's really difficult to distill that when you're in a culture war, when you're trying to get power, when you're seeking power in a political sense, which is one thing that I wonder what you think about, like distilling, you know, gender, let's say, into power relationships can be good for getting one's way or affecting structural change, but doesn't it have downstream effects? Like not everything is power, or do we forget that there are different ways in which power operates on these different levels, the interpersonal level, the, you know, in the bedroom and in the boardroom, et cetera?
Yeah, I think there's kind of huge confusion about what people refer to when they talk about power.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, everyone's supposed to implicitly understand what power is. I mean, but is power having a lot of money? Is it being very strong? Is it being very attractive? Is it, you know,
is being free to do, free from certain rules, free from certain weights? Yeah. from or free for, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, but it's generally like people with, it's a bad thing, you know, so it's like people are abusing their power, or people have power and they shouldn't have it, or, you know, figures are seen to be powerful. But again, it's maybe this responsibility question as well. I mean, if you're the CEO of a large company, you also have enormous amounts of responsibility, which would be a nightmare. I couldn't imagine anything worse than running a major company. It would be like, my goodness me. I mean, I wouldn't be able to like run around the field all afternoon.
You feel towards being a CEO what a lot of people feel towards writing a book, but at least you've written your books, right?
Yeah, although it's painful. I'm not going to lie. It's not easy. It's a horrible thing to do. No.
I looked for the book. Is it published yet?
No, it's out in August.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So you have some, you're still fiddling around with it.
It's done.
Typeset. Okay. Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't want to ask the question, but I have to ask the question. What do men want and why do you want to know?
Right. So the title is a jokey reference to Freud, who very infamously asked the question, what does woman want? Right. So like with my previous book, like One Dimensional Woman is a joke about Marcuse's One Dimensional Man, obviously. It's also a joke on play on the words men and women, because man is also the neutral term, right? But then I kind of sexed it by saying man and woman, right? So in the Freud joke is similar. So it's the same idea. It's like, okay, well, Freud asked this question. Why can't I ask this question? And of course, basically I say it's completely unanswerable. Of course, I don't know what men want, right? Yeah. But I have this bit in the introduction where I asked a lot of my male friends to tell me what they wanted. So there's a whole like list of things that men want.
Like wanted out of life, out of women, out of...
There are a whole range of things. So they say like, you know, a shed or to be left alone or a beer or pussy or a pleasant woman or, you know, whatever. So there's a whole like list of things. But of course, I mean, like telling, you know, the idea that you can say what a whole category of humanity's desire is completely idiotic. Of course you can't. Like, so I don't pretend to answer the question, but I think it's just a very funny title in that kind of.
But why do you want to know? Like, what's compelling you to want to know what men want?
I suppose I'm interested in this question of desire and how it plays out politically and socially. And I suppose, you know, as I started by saying, you know, given that men seem to be really being kind of punished by at least a certain section of the media in the last 5-10 years. It was a kind of question about, you know, what's going on with that, really, I suppose. Of course, there are like infinitely different men, you know, like I know loads of men and they're all really different from each other, right? Women are, you know, so this idea also of like denying people's individuality and, you know, their very different modes of being in the world, I think, you know, was really irritating when you read these things about toxic masculinity and so on, and like everything being spun. So even things like mansplaining, you know, this idea that like if a man tells you, mansplaining, it's like, a man talks to you about something he's really into, you know, and you're like, oh, that's bad. Why? Because it might be really interesting. And sometimes people get carried away, you know, they start going on about something they're into and it's not, it doesn't tell you anything bad about them. You know, it's like they might just be enthusiastic or overexcited.
Yeah, there's a way to steelman that, because I did a short little one-off video about that, because the UN women, paragons of communication skills, came out, like, I think it was on International Men's Day, too. So they bash on men when it's Men's Day, and then they decenter women when it's Women's Day. So, whatever, okay. That's a whole other conversation, but, you know, they were talking about mansplaining or whatever like that, and I made a video, you know, just talking about the dynamics of that, and reading people, and being around somebody who doesn't read you, you know, and how do you interact with somebody who's not good at reading that you don't want to hear what they have to say. And, you know, women gave me some comments about how, like, there is these dynamics between the sexes where men assume that they know more than you. And so they'll talk down to you. Have you experienced that yourself? And how do you read that or recontextualize that into you being empowered or whatever?
No, because I'm so arrogant and so clever myself that they never bother doing that with me.
Okay. Oh, really? So you walk into the room, they're like, what do I do? They roll out the carpets.
No, sure, but I think a subtlety. Like, there's subtlety in these things. You know, I think it's, you know, every interaction is different and complicated. And I think that, you know, there are ways that people can understand if they're being a bit boring or whatever. And everybody's done it, you know. And, like, I don't know. It's, I mean, I do think there are kind of differences in the way in which men and women are socialized. And this is why the second wave wanted to change that, because you know, I do think women are still a bit trained, and I feel it myself, to be very patient with men. You know, like, you're kind of taught to put men's feelings first in some ways, and it's very subtle how these things are communicated, actually. And
are you not being trained to wait out the man in a way? I mean, patience is the skill of the powerful, because I spent a lot of time working with children, preschool, and what you have to learn is patience. You have to learn to let them have their emotion and then understand that you're playing the longer game. So I wonder if a way that the socialization, if there's not a positive reading on that socialization, women put men's feelings first because they're going to run out, and then they're going to get into a very weak, malleable state, and then you get to set them up in a different direction. I'm just saying, long-term
maybe,
thinking.
You know. Maybe. I mean, I suppose, you know, it depends. Yeah, there's a form of dialogue and a form of conversation that, say, between friends, which is kind of infinite, potentially, right? It's an ongoing conversation. You can talk about everything, and it's wonderful to have this partnership with somebody, right? To have a dialogue with whoever, you know, a friend of either sex. And, you know, I mean, if you're talking about kind of a romantic relationship, yeah, I think probably if a woman thinks that this man is a kind of interesting proposition, they would be willing to put up with a lot in order to sort of secure that man if that's what they wanted. Sure, yeah. I don't deny that, but that's not the kind of the vast quantity of interactions that we have with one another,
right? So you're talking more like in stranger situations or in professional situations?
Yeah, I mean, so the book, I talk about heterosociality, right? The fact that we live in a mixed world. So rather than heterosexuality, but heterosociality, the fact that men and women are together. You know, most people go to co-ed schools, most workplaces are completely mixed, you know, like our average interactions with people. And, you know, this kind of complicated question about the extent to which we see a person and the extent to which we see sex, you know, it's like, how do we see them? You know, we obviously see both. If we have an interaction with someone, we make a judgment about who they are. Perhaps, you know, we think, oh, that person's in a good mood, or that seems like a nice person, or, you know, or that person's like unpleasant or whatever. But do we see that as kind of absolutely overlaying their sex, you know, or not, right? What is character apart from sex, if you see what I mean? Most of the time it doesn't matter. Most of the time we don't need to resolve that question, actually.
Yeah.
It's only in particular situations that it might matter. And, yeah, we might have a preference for which sex we prefer to spend time with, you know. And I think a lot of the sort of attacks on men in recent years have often been around this idea of men wanting to spend time with other men, you know, like that, as if that's a bad thing, you know, as if we must be mixed all the time, you know, and there shouldn't be spaces where there are men only or women only. But I think the sex segregated spaces of all kinds are very important, actually. Like, the older I get, the more I kind of understand the value of having sex segregated moments. You know, to have a friendship group that's all female, for example, is an amazing thing. You know, and for men to talk to other men, whatever they're doing, you know, it seems very important. And that would have happened a lot more in different, you know, in the past. You know, jobs and things would have been segregated by sex much more. You know, and again, we can't go back. But at the same time, I don't think people should be punished for wanting, like, for men wanting to have a manhood or something, you know, or for women to want to spend time with other women.
Yeah. Have you, in your book, What Men Want, have you collected stories, or did you, do you have anything to say about what men get out of relationships with other men and what men get out of men's segregated spaces and activities?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, I don't go into sports. Like, I sort of deliberately say I'm not, you know, going to talk about sports, because that's
okay.
huge. No, but it's a huge area. I mean, like,
you talk about gaming though.
Like, yeah, I talk about the game a lot. I talk about different forms of game. I talk about pickup artists, and you know that's a game. And
that, is that, you know, do you think that of as kind of a male way of looking at things, a male kind of something that jives with the male mentality, gaming and thinking of things as that
I think it's a human thing. I mean, I think I like the Huttinger argument about Homo ludens, you know, that we're all game playing, you know, that, and so I'm basically just saying, like, we should play more fun games, you know, that the games we're told to play are just really boring, and we could play more experimental games and come up with our own games.
That's why I like Flirtation.
And so Flirtation is one of those sorts of games, right? It's like, and, you know, but it's a problem if people don't want to play, you know. So I think one thing that had, like, the original
then the game is to get them to play the game with you, which is a whole other game.
Yeah, exactly. But the original pickup artists, they were cool in a way. They were awful, but they did run the risk of, like, being punched in the face or having real life interactions, because they were actually going up to people in women in bars and, like, running that risk. Whereas I think, you know, with the apps and everything, you have this kind of total homogenization, kind of compartmentalization.
Yeah, we've offloaded the game in a way to the to the computer, to the Turing machine in a way. So we're kind of missing out on that aspect of the fun in a way.
Yeah. So then everything becomes like very regulated, and I talk about this idea of like a blockchain for consent and this kind of thing.
Oh, could you expand on that? That's a clever idea.
No, well, it's a terrible idea, but it's, so it's this idea that you could record every interaction. So in case you've got kind of sort of called up later on.
Oh, no, that's a terrible idea. I'm sure it's already happening.
Yeah, it was proposed. It never got off the ground, but I talk about this idea.
Oh, God, that's as scary as the China social credit score, but for dating.
Yeah,
I think it's the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, this is sort of where we're headed, right, in a way. And I think a lot of the Me Too stuff was actually resentment about technology not existing at particular points, so things couldn't be recorded. So I actually think there's a lot of stuff is resentment against the past for not being recordable.
Are you talking about like violations of social norms up to and including sexual harassment? Those weren't able to be quantified and recorded through... tape recorders and cell phones.
You know, so it's also a kind of punishment of the past.
Huh. You know? Yeah.
It's very hard to imagine an age now where there isn't recordability.
Yeah, yeah. Most science fiction movies are ruined for me now whenever they have like a private conversation between two people that's going to like decide the fate of the plot of the spaceship, right? It's like, don't you record everything in every corner of that spaceship? Because aren't we all recorded now? Like, it's just like that's something that breaks my immersion because we are infinitely recorded now.
Yeah.
Speaking as a podcaster.
Yeah, he's recorded, obviously.
The resentment of technology, the resentment of the past. What's your stance then on the past, on the subjugation of women, on the uneven distribution of power and resources between male and female, up to and including negative resources such as death and certain types of suffering that were divvied up between men and women? What's your kind of stance towards the past? And that's important to understand the second question, which is what is your stance towards the future? Pessimistic, optimistic? How do we get to either, you know, the black pill or the red?
Yeah, or the white one. I suppose, I think, to answer the future question, I'm optimistic, right? So I think, right, and I'm not the only person who said this, but like, if we talk about the sexual revolution in the 60s, right, every revolution ends in terror. Me Too is like the terror moment in the French Revolution, right? Mm. So you have the kind of decapitation of the men who were the most took advantage of the sexual revolution, right? Who are the greatest sexual revolutionaries, right? These men are all punished for being too into it. And then after that, you have Thermidor, right? You have this kind of, let's say, slowing down of like the revolutionary urge.
Yeah.
So you have a period in which like, everything's a bit more ambiguous and a bit more mixed. Hmm. And you say, oh yeah, there were some bad things and, you know, okay, but we're all here now. We have to get along. And like, how can we sort of talk about it? And I think, you know, so that kind of level of negotiation and reconciliation is not to say let's deny the horrors of the past, or let's not deny resentment and bad feeling and, you know, often very justified in some cases, but let's all acknowledge that we're all capable of harm, that all of us have made mistakes, you know, and that we're all relatively similar in certain ways. We're all human, right? And we're all alive. And so in that sense, I think I'm optimistic, because I think the kind of hyper-moralism can't hold. I think it, you know, I think it's often a manifestation of people's own guilt or their own feelings of inadequacy, you know,
to, or meaninglessness in a way,
And I think that life becomes, especially the older you get, the more ambivalent and ambiguous life becomes in certain ways. Yeah. You know, the more you realize that things aren't so straightforward, and that maybe human beings in the past had some good ideas, you know, and even if we don't want to keep all of them, we might want to keep some of them. And, you know, and so I mean, to talk about human history and the relation to the history of men and women is a very, very complicated thing, right? It's not, I can't give you a simple story, right? Like, I think the, you know, patriarchy, we've already discussed to some extent, I mean, clearly is a real thing, right? It clearly exists. And this complicated question of property and who is and who isn't property, and, you know, the role of property in the relation between men and women, and, you know, is, I don't know how to put it. It's too complicated a question. We'd have to look at particular periods at particular moments and look at, you know, and when we're talking about emancipation, it's like freedom to do what in what realm, you know, whether you look at like the political realm. Okay, so women got the vote just over 100 years ago in the UK. It's not a very long time ago that women have had political representation. And yet already I think there's a lot of political dispossession. I think a lot of women feel very politically dispossessed. Like, you know, I was sort of very involved in like leftist stuff for a long time. And I think you're right that there's this kind of, you know, a lot of men pledge allegiance to sort of feminism, but if you disagree with them, they suddenly don't anymore. It's just like, you're an annoying woman, right? It's like, you are free to kind of be political insofar as you agree with me, you know? But the moment you don't agree with me, then you're not political anymore. You're just an annoying person.
So, or you're in the way of my politics, and so I'm going to marginalize you and regulate you to a sideline.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, that the actual reality by this moment is that actually, if you do grant women political representation and emancipation in that way, then you actually have to listen to them. And they might be saying something different than what you want them to say. You know, and that's the thing, we're in this moment in some ways. You know, so that, you know, there is no going back. And I don't think people would want to go back. It's hard to imagine, right? It's, you know, once you engage in mass education, once you have women's mass entry into the workforce, you know, you have all these moments. And, you know, that's just kind of where we are, if you like. And, you know, women still, a lot of them still want to be with men. You know, they, I think if men were so awful, you'd be seeing a lot more female separatist movements.
Do you interact with the, I guess Gen Z is the current crop of college going youth? Are you teaching right now, like lecture style? Are you?
I'm actually teaching adult education at the moment, which is largely to retired people, which is very interesting.
Okay, you're actually working with Justin Murphy. He's getting a project off the ground that looks really promising of projecting courses into the ether for people to take. But you're actually working with the college in the capacity.
Yeah, but I have worked with Justin as well. Like, I did this course on Bataille with him, and I'm working on developing some other ones. Yeah, so there's, I'm doing like lots of different things. I was lecturing at a university for 13 years in London. But I left, I was really ill. I had to recover from like my stupid alcohol addiction. And then I took time off, and then I just left. And also I didn't like the way the university was going, like the university as such was going.
I think
students were becoming very anxious, and they're borrowing so much money. You know, it's like you end up, they're ending up in $50,000 of debt, and know, I just didn't think it was sustainable, and it wasn't kind of making me happy.
What is your take on the future of higher education writ large? Yeah. We can talk either about the academy system or just what is higher education? Where is it going to go?
I think it's going to collapse to a large degree. I think the elite institutions will remain. I think you'll see more and more like diversification onto platforms, the kind of thing that Justin's doing, because, you know, we're offering a course that's like, you know, as good as something that people are borrowing like 40K for, right? So they don't get the accreditation, right? But if you're genuinely interested in the topic, why wouldn't you pay very little money ultimately listen to people who know what they're talking about and have this brilliant seminar with lots of other interesting people. So I think you're going to see the fragmentation of that.
And you know, how adjunct professors have been marginalized, they don't get like benefits and then they're paid very little. So if they just move to online, they get direct money. There's actually, it looks more lucrative to go that route for the teachers.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's certainly, absolutely. And without all the bureaucracy, without all of the, you know, meetings and all of the horror that attends working at these places.
Yeah. And the threat of being canceled for something really stupid, but because you're complained to by the student.
No, exactly. And, I think that kind of, you know, the inhibiting of free speech or discussion, you know, I mean, if you teach philosophy, the whole point is to encourage people to say random things, to try out ideas, to make mistakes, you know, to test an argument. And that does require people actually being able to accept hearing difficult things or disagreement, you know, and if people are too frightened to say, to test out ideas, then they're never going to get better at thinking, you know. And I'm not blaming young people for feeling like that, right? I think that it's nothing to do with them individually. It's not a moral individual question, but it's the general climate in which, you know, like, let's say you having a conversation about, I don't know, abortion or euthanasia in a philosophy class, and someone records someone saying something, you know, trying out an idea or saying something bad, and then, you know, so people maybe feel like they can't say anything, you know.
In with regards to teaching or professing, are you into like symposium, small group dialogue, or are you into lecturing, being the rock star or the box star perhaps?
No, I don't know. I mean, anything really. I kind of just like, you know, all dialogues really, says naively. I'm kind of interested in talking to anybody. Like, I'll speak to anybody. I don't have any kind of...
Hence the ease of getting you on my channel.
Oh, yeah, sure. But I mean, it's like, you know, I was, you know, really kind of punished for speaking to people like Justin and Daniel Miller, who are deemed to be, you know, beyond the pale. It's like, how can you speak to these people, even though they're perfectly reasonable and lovely people, you know, and it's... But this is kind of increasingly how it is, like this guilt by association. It's like, oh, you can't talk to him. Isn't he this? Doesn't he think that or whatever, you know? But I think that's kind of ending. It must surely end, because not least is it very boring. I mean, who wants to live in a world in which everyone says the same thing?
Yeah.
And there's no arguments.
And it's going to be the worst common denominator of the same thing, too, ultimately. It's going to be like the worst of worst things that you have to say and can't say or whatever.
Yeah, and that's a terribly boring world. Like, philosophers don't want that world.
Was there like a moment in your development, your Bildungsroman, where you knew you're going to be a philosopher, or why you chose to go this route? Was there something that said, oh, this is for me?
Yeah, I think it was insomnia. I had chronic insomnia as a child and as a teenager, like brutal. Really? Yeah. And I like struggled to sleep all the time, and to the extent that it was absolutely damaging my life. And
yeah.
I suppose just in that kind of just permanent wakefulness when there was nobody there to talk to, everyone else is asleep, you know, and I suppose just that kind of absolute openness to thoughts of all kinds. I don't know. And then I would just read manically. So I kind of filled my head with all of these ideas as well. And then I couldn't sleep. And so I suppose it was that.
So you started with the symposium in your head then?
Yeah, I suppose so.
Huh, wow.
Yeah.
And what's next for you after you do your wild book tour about men and wanting desire?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to. I'd actually quite like to write a book about Gen X, being a member of Gen X.
And you one?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
Yeah,
and
me too.
I think there's.
It's kind of shocking to realize that I thought you were a millennial.
Yeah, I'm actually, well, I don't know. Do you talk about how old you are? Do you mention this in your?
It's all about the guest. And every time I talk to a woman about this, I get residual surrogate offendedness from certain females. Like, never say that. Yeah.
No. So like I'm 42. So I was born in the late 70s. And it's just really funny because I was really like overweight and ill and addicted a few years ago, and I looked really, really bad, and then I got really fit. So it's quite funny. And
then you got cancelled.
Yes, because I could think clearly again. But so I'm very interested in Gen X though, because of this sandwich nature and the fact that all of our heroes are dead. And you know, there's something very interesting about being part of the last generation that had a childhood without the internet. I think so. There's, and obviously you have figures like Bret Easton Ellis who are very interesting commentators in this regard. But I think there's kind of more to be said about Gen X. And I've just been reading this book about boomers, and it's very funny. And so I think there's a kind of maybe something I'd like to say about our generation.
Yeah, there's a kind of this wave effect that's taken where we were kind of overshadowed by the boomers storytelling wise, just the growing up in the shadow of the 60s, where they had this great coming out and they had all this great art and they had all these really important movements. And we were kind of in this slump of, I guess, in our coming of age, H.W. Bush and then Clinton. Which is like, okay, I guess PC culture kind of, you know, and then the dot-com boom, right? And then, but we kind of missed out on a lot of the, like the big social change. And now we're kind of watching another crop of youth, like experience a resurgence of kind of boomer energy in a way, if I may use that phrase. And I find that our role now is to, because we're gonna age out of positions of power because the boomers are going to hold on to it for so long, it's just gonna drop into the laps of maybe even just Gen Z. But our it seems like our role is to be counselors in a way, is to add kind of a different voice to the conversation and guide people towards use our tools of irony, sarcasm, and apathy towards the good of mankind. Finally,
I completely agree with you. I really, really do. I honestly think these are very interesting cultural skills that we were taught, you know, voluntarily or otherwise. And I think humor, you know, is so important. And you know, a lot of the time it's like, you know, when you see all these sort of online battles and people misunderstanding, it's like, look, if we just sat down and like we talked about it and we'd realize that like we're all idiots and like, you know, it's not that big a deal. And like, do you know what I mean? It's like,
sexist, racist, who cares? Be a misogynist. Or no, not a misogynist, an anthropope, a misanthrope.
That's
what we should all aim for.
But genuinely, I think there's a political value in that, in all seriousness, which is to say, like, if you can lightheartedly deal with serious things, it's not to diminish their seriousness, but it's actually to prevent them from escalating, you know, so into properly warlike confrontational situations.
Or terror,
So, I mean, I really like, and I really like your idea of this, the role of counselor or, like, you know, someone who diffuses a situation. Yeah. You know, say, look, like, everybody suffers. Like, let's acknowledge, you know, how weird life is. Nobody knows.
The avuncular generation, right? The uncles and the aunts, you know, like
we're all
addicted to gambling and pills and stuff. But we come in and lighten up the room.
Yeah. And just be like, hey, guys, you know, oh, whatever. I think, I think there is a role for us in this way. And But it's a serious role, but like a funny one too. And just to kind of calm everyone down, just be like, it's okay.
It's okay. It's fine. It'll be okay if you don't fuck it up too much. Are you going to set up a podcast like every other academic in the world? Or do you have any other multimedia engagements that we can plug or on your...
I'm currently starting one. It's with two other people. It's called The Lack, but it's not out yet.
Like The Lack.
Dalek. Yeah, it's kind of quite psychoanalytic, and it talks about films and things.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, like everybody, I'm probably so torn about the internet that half the time I just want to, like, you know, throw the thing out of the window and then run away and live in a field. And so I don't know. I think I was just thinking today about how the sunlight, you know, destroys screens. You can't really see your screen when the sun is out, you know, and this is why they want to cancel the sun. You know, this is the thing, the hill I will die on.
They're canceling the sun now?
They're going to cancel the sun. They want to block out the sun. Honestly. Wait, Bill Gates has this idea to, like, you know, block out the sun. It's like
to outsource a photosynthesis or something.
Yeah, no, it's really, Mars? Really bad. Yeah, so
wait, are you serious? Like, Bill Gates is going to make a Chernobyl chamber over our planet?
Yeah. They're going to block out the sun. So seriously, like, this is the one thing I do care about, is not blocking out the sun. And this is the war I will fight.
Okay. Wait, you're serious, though? They're going to make, like, some Ray-Bans for the southern and northern hemisphere.
I can send you the link. That's what they're proposing. It's one of their great suggestions to save the planet.
The Great Reset, man.
Yeah.
Those freaking boomers, man. They're like turning into mad scientists now.
They need to retire.
Like, what can we do next? Like,
they need to enjoy their gated community or whatever they, you know, read some books. Yeah. Enjoy the sun. Yeah, seriously.
Nina, you're a wonderful person to talk to, a wonderful interlocutor. I have to go back to my OED to figure out the correct pronunciation. But it was great to have you on. Thank you for joining me.
No worries. I hope I hope you have a lovely day. And it was nice to be on. And I was a bit deranged because I did spend too much time outside today. So I was a little bit more discombobulated than I would normally be. I'd normally be a bit more ordered.
I really, really enjoyed the pace and our scattery Gen X way of picking up topics and throwing them around like toys.
Yes, it's also a strategy, I suppose.
Well, cool. I'll end the recording there.
Congratulations for reaching the end of the discussion. If you enjoyed it, do be sure to leave a review or a comment or a thumbs up or whatever you need to do to show that glorious algorithm that this is some good stuff. And do be sure to go and check that back catalog, as it is brimming full of fantastic conversations. Links to provide monetary support are down there in the description as well. Have a good night.